reason and she almost weeps with rage. Then he told her, shyly, because he was ashamed, of his bargain with God, and how he'd been prepared to lose his wife into Luke's hands, his needles and blades, if the signs had seemed auspicious. News came of Garrett's injury, and if I didn't exactly think it a sign, certainly Stella did. She looked relieved. She told me she'd have had the operation if I'd thought it best, but preferred to give herself over to God. Sometimes I think she wants to leave us, that she wants to go away from me. Cora concealed a look at her friend, who so rarely seemed less than in command, that it threw her. She said, "I remember when Michael was first taken ill. We were having breakfast, and he couldn't swallow. He went rigid and red and pulled at the tablecloth, then flapped at his throat. And since he never panicked or let down his guard, not ever, we knew something was wrong. Just then, a bird flew in, and God knows I've never been superstitious, but for a moment I thought of that old wives' tale that a bird indoors foretells a death, and my heart lifted, and I sat and watched him choke. Then, of course, I came to my senses, and we gave him water, and he vomited, and later that month he passed blood, and Luke came. It was the first time I ever saw him, and I was a little afraid of him, to speak the truth. Isn't it odd how strangers come over the threshold, and you never know what they might become?" "Oh," she shook her head, "I don't know what point I'm making. How can I compare him to Stella? They might be different species. Only that it takes us strangely. All this." She flung out her arms, and he was grateful. What a strange habit she had of offering up understanding out of her thorough disagreement with almost everything he knew and prized. Evening had come quickly, and the rosy sun was caught below a black bank of cloud. Light struck only the lower part of the beech and chestnut trees and left the rest in darkness. It gave the appearance of ranks of bronze pillars bearing up a thick black canopy. They'd come to a slight rise, and the path was traversed at regular intervals by forest roots that formed a broad and shallow flight of stairs. Everywhere was thickly mossed, and it laid down a carpet of vivid green. For all their talking and delight, there'd been little of the intimacy of their letters, which spoke so readily of "I" and "you." But as the wood closed around them, it seemed possible to approach the heart of the matter, though tentatively and by small degrees. "I was glad when you wrote," he said diffidently. "I'd had a bad day of it. And then there you were, on the doormat." "I am glad I swallowed my pride." She put her foot on the green stair and paused and said, "You were so angry with me after Luke tried out his tricks on Joe. And I've never minded anyone being angry with me if I deserved it, but I didn't think I did. It was only an offer of help. If you'd seen what I saw, those laughing girls, how they laughed and snapped their heads back and forth." He shook his head, impatient. "It doesn't matter now. What use would it be to go over it?" Then he laughed and said, "I always did enjoy fighting with you, but not over anything that mattered." "Only matters of good and evil."
"Exactly. Look, we are in a cathedral."
High overhead, the trees stooped and made a chancel arch. A branch had sheared off a nearby oak and left behind a peaked cavity above a deep shelf.
"It looks as though
Cromwell's taken hammer and chisel to a saint.
"I see you've dispatched the serpent in your church, at least," said Cora. "I went in the day I came back, and there's nothing but a few scales left. What made you lose your patience?"
Thinking of that shameful moment on the midsummer marsh after he'd left them all behind, Will coughed and said,
"Joanna would have boxed my ears if news of Cracknell hadn't come in time. Look, all these conkers lying about, and no children taking them home."
He bent to pick up a handful and passed one to her, snug in its green casing. With a fingertip in the split, she prized it open and found the nut in its white silk bed.
"I was angry," he said. "That's all. Now the trouble has gone, I hardly remember how it was. How folk kept indoors, and we never heard the children playing. And how nothing I could say would convince them. There was nothing to fear they didn't summon up themselves."
"I felt it in the village as soon as I came," she said. "A change of air. I heard the school choir singing, and not until I was home did I remember the day they'd laughed and laughed, and something went badly wrong. To think, when I first came, there was rarely anyone on the common, and I thought I'd see people look at me mistrustfully, as if it were all my fault, as if it had anything to do with me."
"Sometimes I think it was," said Will, dropping his hands, kicking at the moss.
He gave her one of his chastening looks, and only half in jest. She said, laughing,
"The trouble might not be my doing, but I hardly helped. I made other things muddled. What you said in your letter, that you'd come to the end of new things. I realize then how I go blundering about. I forced myself in. I might as well have broken a window. Imagine saying we should write to each other when you were barely half a mile away. And all because we talked once."
"There was also the question of the sheep," said Will.
"There was that, of course."
They looked at each other, relieved to have overstepped the crack opening in the path before them. But it widened, and they tripped. Will said,
"My windows were already broken."
"No."
"I left them on the latch."
"And why?"
"Why was it? When I had everything a man asks, I saw you, and ever since was glad of you."
"It's not surprising to me." Cora prized the conker from its shell and rolled it between her palms. "Did you really think because you loved here, you couldn't love there?" "Poor Will.
Poor boy.
Did you think you had so little of it?"
"Look, should I boil it, bake it, or pickle it in vinegar?"
She made as if to throw it at him, but he'd turned away and moved a step or two above her.
"It's like talking to a child," he said, exasperated. "I know what you think of me, secretly, even secret from yourself, that I'm a god-addled half-wit, fallen miles behind you, as if you've evolved past me."
She surveyed him somberly and, he thought, with amusement very faintly at the corner of her mouth, and it made him press home his point more cruelly than he meant.
"Look at you. Whichever Cora you are, the one in silk and diamonds, or the one who wears clothes Cracknell would have thrown away. The one always laughing at us, or the one vowing love to anyone who'll listen. You wall yourself away because you know as well as I do.
You've almost run through your youth without ever having been loved as you should have been. Stop it, Cora said. All the intimacy she'd sought by letter was unbearable out there under the black forest canopy. She wanted to be back in their safe territory of ink and paper, and not here, where her colour rose and she thought she could smell, above the sweetness of a distant fire, the scent of his body under his shirt. It was indecent. He was, at his best, sealed in an envelope. That he was so unavoidably a thing of blood and bones made it impossible to ignore the strong pulse beating in her neck. "Come down," she said. "Come back. Don't fight with me. Haven't we had enough of that?" A little ashamed, he stooped beside a chestnut tree, rooting among fallen leaves for conkers, handing them to her one by one. "I wish we were children," said Cora, closing her fingers over them, remembering how once they'd been treasures to be bartered and prized. She came closer. She sat beside him on the moss. "Why can we not be like children and play together?" "Because you're not innocent," said Will. There was a strange vertiginous feeling, as if what they were saying had flung them high up, and they'd not yet fallen. "You are not innocent, and nor am I. You play at it, you fend me off." He tugged at her sleeve, a little rough. "Do you think because you wear a man's coat, I might forget what you are?" "And do you think I do it for you?" she said. "I forget I'm a woman. I set it aside. God knows I'm no mother and was never much of a wife. Do you think I should torture myself with high-heeled shoes and paint out my freckles so you're kept on your guard against me?"
"No. I think you're guarding against yourself. You told me once you'd like to be nothing but an intellect, disembodied, untroubled by your own flesh and blood."
"I would! I would! I despise it. My body only ever betrayed me. I don't live in it. I live up here, in my mind and words."
"Yes," he said. "Yes. I know, yes. But here you are too. Here." And moving aside the folds of her coat, he tugged her shirt where it was tucked at the waist, in the place where once he'd touched her and been disgraced by it. But the disgrace this time kept its distance. It seemed to him that to keep apart from her now would be obscene. How could it be possible to seek out each fold and turn of her mind and not grow familiar with the particular patina of her skin, the scent and taste of it? Not to touch her now would be to breach a natural law. Back she lay against the soft green stair in the thickening dusk and fixed her eyes on his, unsurprised, daring him. He raised her shirt. And there in the split, between the black cloth of her clothes, he found her soft belly, very white, marked with the silver lines her son had made. He kissed it once and could not stop, and she rolled against him in delight. The sun slid down, the forest closed about them. The copper on the pillars of the trees turned to verdigris. The gilded temple was gone, and in its place there was the scent of leaf mould and long grass dying and windfall apples splitting on the path. She met his gaze then, levelly as she always had, and felt herself go rushing to meet him like a river in spate. "Please," she said, pulling at her skirt. "Please." And he heard it like a command. He found her easily,
and his hands slipped and moved in her, and her bright head drooped, and she was silent. He showed her his hand, and how she gleamed there. He put a forefinger to his mouth and hers, and they had an equal share. Chapter 6 Later, that same night, hardly 5 miles distant, Luke Garrett walked alone beside barley fields harvested white. He'd taken it into his head to walk the River Colne, setting out in that meantime before dawn, when even the lightest burden is intolerable and the prospect of sunrise laughably remote. Though the moon had not yet set, the sky in the east was stained with light, and the fields gave rise to mist. In places it thickened into scraps coming at him as he walked. They breathed wetly on his cheek, then dissipated like sighs. Some time back he'd lost the Colne, and neither knew nor cared where he might pitch up. If he could, he'd have walked clean out of his own skin. The Essex land, to his London eye, was uniform in its strangeness. All the fields were ploughed black, save here and there where barley stubble glowed pale under the setting moon, and the low hedges seethed with life. The ranks of oaks were sturdy watchmen, surveying him as he passed. He was an impostor. He came in time to an incline, where grass grew thick, from which it was possible to see out across a modest rise and fall to a village drowsing in the hollow, and here he rested against an oak. By disease or bad luck, it had shed its leaves early, and in among the branches mistletoe showed vivid green, even in that murky light. He supposed another man might look up and think of mouths kissed under Christmas sprigs. But he knew it for a parasite, leeching all that was good from its host. Hanging in the bare branches, the bundles looked, he thought, like nothing so much as tumours growing on a lung. Having come to a halt, he encountered many separate pains. His feet, unused to walking much beyond an urban mile or so, were rubbed raw against his boots. His knee was swelling where he'd stumbled, swearing, over a stile. Worst, he'd let his injured hand hang loosely by his side, so that blood, collecting there, throbbed against the healing cut. Where knife and scalpel had scored the palm, the flesh looked rather like a thin mouth, stitched shut. "There was a crooked man," he said, "who walked a crooked mile." But he could hardly resent the pains, since they distracted from the frantic misery that had dogged him since his arrival from London with a good-for-nothing hand and in his pocket Cora's letter. "How could you?" she'd said, and he'd felt her anger and understood it. How could he? "Own nothing which is not beautiful or useful," she'd once said, and he was neither. A squat, glaring creature, as near to being beast as man. And now, he pushed the thumb of his left hand into the damaged palm of his right and reeled with a shock of it. Useless to boot. Since the day the knife had gone in, he'd woken each night drenched in sweat that collected in the hollow of his collarbones and left his pillow damp. "Useless," he'd say, beating a clenched fist against his temples until his head ached. "Useless! Useless!" All that gave him purpose had been taken in a matter of hours. Sometimes he woke forgetting, and for fleeting seconds the world was spread out before him invitingly. There were his notebooks and his models of the heart with its chambers and pipes. There the letter Edward Burton wrote in the early days as he healed. and beside it an envelope into which Cora had put a piece of stone and an explanatory note in her schoolboy hand. Then he'd remember, and see it was all false as stage props, and the black curtain would fall. It was not melancholy, he felt. He might have welcomed that, imagining it possible to enjoy a fading sadness that found companionship on memorial benches. Instead, he veered between bitter fury and a curious deadening that dwindled his whole range of feeling to little but a shrug. Under the oak, in the coming dawn, he grew calm. "If I am useless," he thought, "can I not discard myself?" He had no duty to go on living, no obligation to walk a yard further. There was no God to censure or console. He answered to no intelligence but his own. Over in the east a coral light struck the low cloud, while Luke laid out reasons for living and found each insufficient. Once his ambition had driven him on through poverty and disgrace, now it belonged to a lost age. His mind was now muddied and slow, and besides, what use was it, matched to a mutilated hand? Once he might have let love for Cora sustain him, but he'd lost that too. Her outrage hadn't extinguished it, not quite, only turned it into something secret and furtive of which he was ashamed. Would she grieve him? He supposed she would, and imagined her putting on one of those black dresses that made her skin so pale, and imagined William Ransom looking up from his books to see her there on the threshold, her lips parted a little, a tear gleaming on her cheek. Oh, certainly she'd grieve. She did it so well, after all. He pictured his mother's grief. Well, she'd never yet had his photo on the mantelpiece. Perhaps she'd enjoy finding a silver frame going cheap in the market and tuck behind the glass a black curl of his baby hair. There was Martha, of course. The thought of her raised something like a smile. What they'd done on Midsummer Night had delighted them both, but it had also been only a poor substitute. "What a mess," he thought. "What a mess we make." If love were an archer, someone had put out its eyes, and it went stumbling about, blindly letting loose its arrows, never meeting its mark. No, there was no reason to continue. Let the curtain fall when he chose it. He looked up at the branches of the oak, and they were sturdy enough for a gallows. Just a moment longer there on the earth, with the mist rising, then, since there was neither a hell to shun nor a heaven to gain, he'd go out with the Essex clay under his nails and filled with the scent of morning. He drew in a breath, and all the seasons were in it. Spring greenness in the grass, and somewhere a dog rose blooming. The secretive scent of fungus clinging to the oak, and underneath it all, something sharper, waiting in a promise of winter. A vixen grew near, and turned her gaslight eyes upon him, then drew back and sat surveying him a while. She cocked her head, considered his position on her territory, concluded he might stay, and losing interest, nosed at the white plume on her breast. Then she grew avid and merry with hunger, and went down the hill in little leaps, sometimes spying something in the grass, jackknifing with her forepaws crooked, and vanished down the incline with her bright brush held high. Luke felt a love for her then, which almost made him cry out, and knew that no man ever had a better farewell. Chapter 7. At about the time Luke was choosing his own gallows from among the Essex oaks, Banks sat beside a fire, high up in the shingle, near the black bones of Leviathan, making marks in the logbook.
Visibility poor. Wind northeasterly. High tide, 6:23 a.m.
For all that he'd witnessed the great silver fish lying beached on the saltings with its belly splitting open, Banks knew, with a certainty which had begun to obliterate all others, that the Essex serpent had not been found. How could it, when he woke each night with its breath on his cheek, expected to wake and see himself enfolded in its wet black wing? When all of Old Winter had celebrated, rolling out the cider barrels and draining them dry, he'd sat at a distance alone, thinking of his poor lost daughter and her coral-coloured hair.
"All alone out there, with the flotsam and jetsam," he'd said, "and the mark of the serpent on her." Oh, there was something out there, all right. He'd seen it. He'd marked it. Black it was, and ridged in places, and its appetite unsatisfied.
He drowned his sorrows in bad gin. It fended off the worst of the images that came in the night. But out there, with his face to the rising tide, they came vividly at him. The serpent in the black water, with its livid eye, its blunt snout, how it pawed at his daughter as she rolled dumbly in the shallows.
"Did what I could to keep her dry," said Banks, growing tearful, looking about for a witness and finding none.
She'd been born with a call, had Naomi, and killed her mother coming out. And he'd done as any good sailor would, and put a bit of call in a pewter locket, and she'd worn it every day to fend off water sprites.
"I did what I could," he said,
and the fog rolled in and dawdled by the fire. He took a bottle from his pocket and drained it dry. The spirit stung his throat, and he doubled over, coughing. And when he raised his head, he saw surveying him placidly across the fire the black-haired son of that London woman who'd taken up with the rector.
"Bit early for you, isn't it?" he said.
The child had always unnerved him, with his steady gaze and his habit of patting his pockets over and over. If the beast was to take any child, it ought to have been this one, whose presence raised all the hairs on his neck's nape, who he'd once seen steal 5 blue sweets from behind the counter in the village store.
"But isn't it the same time for me as it is for you?" said Francis Seaborne. "Did you see it?"
"What are you on about? What do you want?" said Banks, choosing to deny the serpent. "Nothing out there, lad. Nothing to see."
"I don't think you think that," said Francis, coming closer. "Because if you did, why would you be here? And what are you writing in your book? Stands to reason."
"Visibility poor," said Banks, flapping the logbook at the boy. "And getting worse. I can hardly see you, never mind the black water."
"I can," said the boy,
and took a hand from his pocket to gesture out east, where the fog banked up above the salt marsh.
"My eyes are good. Over there. Can't you see?"
"Where's your mother? Doesn't she keep you indoors? Keep back, won't you? Where did you go?"
Francis stepped away from the fire into the white air, and for a time Banks was alone again. Then a slender figure appeared from a little away to his left, saying again,
"Didn't you see it then? Can't you hear?"
"No, no, there's nothing there," said Banks, coming to his feet, kicking salt shingle over the fire. "There's nothing there, and I'm going home. Let go of my hand. Only one child ever held it, and she's gone and won't be coming back.
The cold hand in his had a strength out of all proportion to its fingers. The boy tugged at him, trying to draw him near the incoming tide, saying, "Look harder! Look better! Don't you see it?" Banks shook him off, growing afraid, not of what lay out there on the wet mud, but of the child who stared so implacably back at him.
"I'm going home now," said Banks, and turned away.
Then there came from close by the sound of something moving. It was a curious, low, muffled sound, deadened by the thickening fog. It was like the slow grinding of a jawbone, or of something scrabbling for purchase on the shore. Then there was a groan, rather high-pitched, and ending on something like a squeal. And the thick, pale air lifted in the wind, and Banks saw the long, low curve of something dark, hunched, in places glistening smooth, and in others uneven and rough. It shifted against the shingle, and there was the groaning again. Banks called out to the boy, but the fog enclosed him in a pale shroud, and he saw nothing. The glowing embers of the fire beckoned him, and he ran towards it, stumbling in the mud and the high tussocks of marsh grass. Once he fell, and felt his kneecap shift under his skin. Then he half hobbled home. As he went, his heart lifted, despite the terror.
"I was right. Oh, I was right."
Francis, meanwhile, held his ground. He assumed he was afraid, since his palms were wet and his breath was coming fast. But as far as he was concerned, that was no reason to turn tail. He rarely thought of Cora. Not out of contempt, but because she was a constant, and so seemed hardly worth troubling over. But he thought of her then, of how often she bent over a fragment of rock and sketched it, of how she'd beckon him over and tell him the names of what she'd found. Perhaps he could do the same here, or something like it, observe a phenomenon at the closest of quarters, and make a report, and show her. The idea satisfied him. He walked on, and beyond the pale curtain the sun rallied, and the fog began to thin. The wet mud glistened gold, and water began to run in rivulets towards the shingle. There again was the sound of grinding, and a dark shape, shifting a few yards distant, appeared as slowly as if it were just that moment being formed out of the air. Francis stepped forward. A low gust came from the east and whipped at the fog. And there was a bright, clear moment in which he saw plainly what it was that had been cast up on the shore. He numbered his feelings as accurately as any of his treasures. First it was relief, he felt, as his breath slowed and his heart's beating subsided. Then disappointment. Then hard on its heels came mirth. Laughter bubbled up in him and could not be suppressed. He had to ride it out like a coughing fit, or as if he were being sick. After a while, the laughter died back, and he was himself again, drying his eyes with his sleeve, considering how best to proceed. What he'd seen was gone now, hidden behind a fresh bank of fog, or borne out again on the lapping tides. And it was important to settle on what he should do next. Certainly he ought to tell somebody, and it was Cora he thought of first. But no, he ought not to have been out of doors so early in the morning. He imagined her discarding his account in favour of explaining that he had done something wrong, and the idea was intolerable. Then he remembered Stella Ransom, and how he'd visited her in her blue bower, and how she'd let him touch her treasures, and how readily she'd understood that in his own pockets there'd been a bent coin, a fragment of gull's egg, and the empty cup of an acorn. He'd grown so used to being greeted with bemusement and suspicion that her immediate affection earned her his absolute loyalty. He'd tell her what he'd seen, and she'd tell him what to do.
"Dear Mrs. Ransom, I want to tell you something. Please may I visit at a time convenient. Yours sincerely, Francis Seaborn. Master. P.S. I will put this through your door to save time."
Chapter 8. Dr. Garrett found a branch fit to bear a stocky man. Hanging would doubtless be unpleasant. He'd have much preferred a high drop and broken neck to long, slow pressure of his throat. But he understood it, and knew how his tongue would loll, and his bowels loosen, and how blood vessels would lay scarlet cobwebs over the whites of his eyes. And he'd never been afraid of anything he understood. He fumbled at the buckle of his belt, favouring his wounded hand, as if it mattered now what damage was done, or how he pulled at the stitches. And as he looped the strap through the silver buckle to form a noose, his thumb moved across the ridges which formed the symbol there. There it was, the coiled snake, the sign of his profession, the darting tongue picked out with the engraver's tool, the winking eye. It was a mockery. He had no right to it, to think that once he'd walked proudly bearing the sign of gods, of goddesses. Worse, it called to mind, Spencer. His long, anxious face, his loyalty, his habit of seeming always to be dashing after him to prevent some disaster. How extraordinary it was that all the while he'd sat leaning on the gallows he'd chosen, numbering his reasons for living and setting each one aside, he'd never once thought of his friend. It was as if his presence was so constant and so taken for granted that he'd come to be barely noticed. Again he traced the symbol, resentful of its intrusion, and tried also to set Spencer aside. He was a grown man, after all, with pockets as deep as his heart was large. Dull on first meeting, but generally liked. He'd missed Luke, but no more than if he'd gone to another country. But Luke knew this to be untrue. Since their days side by side at the college bench, flaying open severed hands to see their bones and tendons, Spencer had conferred on him a friendship more unerring than any brother could have shown. He'd patiently borne every slight and insult, of which there had been many. By wealth and good manners deflected the rage of tutors and debtors, had by his silent approval enabled every small step Luke made towards his goal. By slow degrees, they'd established an intimacy more easy than that with any lover either had known. Luke remembered a time when Spencer, after too much wine, had lolled against his shoulder, and how he hadn't moved for fear of waking him, though his arm grew stiff and sore. Luke pictured him, waking now in the George, perhaps, in his absurd striped pyjamas with a monogrammed pocket, his fair hair receding, probably thinking of Martha first, then of his friend in the adjoining room. How he dressed too neatly and come quietly down for his egg, wondering when Luke might wake. How then he'd grow uneasy and come knocking on the door. Would he go to the police or come searching himself? Would he find his friend hanging there with the buckle of his belt, shearing the flesh behind his ear? Might he scrabble at the branch to bring him down? No. It was impossible to think that he could do such harm. And it was also unfair. Must he really struggle numbly on for the sake of George Spencer? How humiliating it was that neither the hope of professional glory nor the possession of Cora Seaborne might keep his neck from the noose, but nothing more than a friend. How humiliating! And another failure, even at the end. The calm he'd felt receded, and in its place was the old familiar rage. He thrashed wildly at the grass with the belt, sending up clods of mud, while behind him, in the branches of the oak, something moved, because it had seen the sun. Shortly after noon, Spencer stood wringing his hands at the threshold of the George Hotel and saw a cab draw up. The driver opened the door and thrust out his hand for money. And then there was Luke, with his wounded hand cradled against his shoulder and his black hair all on end. Spencer's righteous fury receded when he saw how the other man stared and stared, with the whites showing all around his eyes and a graze on his cheek as if he'd fallen. "My God, what have you done?" he said, putting out his hand to draw him in. But Luke shook him off like a petulant child and pushed past him into the lobby. The cab driver counted through the coins. "Where was he?" said Spencer. "How far have you come?" But he didn't answer, only shook his head and tapped the side of his head.
"Mad as a hatter, that one."
Above them, a door slammed fit to rattle the windows in their frames, and Spencer went upstairs in dread and hope. His friend stood against the window, looking down onto the Colchester streets. The whole broad bulk of him was rigid. Spencer imagined he might topple over and break in pieces against the bare floor.
"What's happened?" said Spencer, coming nearer. "Is everything all right?"
When the other man turned to look at him, Spencer went cold at the bitterness of his black gaze.
"All right," said Luke,
and his teeth ground against each other. He looked almost as if he might laugh. Then he shook his head and grunted, and lunging at Spencer with his left hand, struck him hard against the temple, splitting the skin above his eye. Spencer reeled against an ugly chest of drawers and swore. His vision was speckled with stars, and behind them, Luke, in his rage and misery, said,
"If it hadn't been for you, it would all be done with now. It would all be finished. God, stop looking at me! I never wanted you here!"
Then, as if he'd been held by a cord suddenly severed, he fell against the closed door and huddled there, cradling his bandaged hand. He did nothing so good and simple as weep, but instead gave out a low and rhythmic groaning that was nearer the grief of animal than man.
"I'm sorry," said Spencer, a little shyly. "It's no good. I'm not going to go away, you know."
Then, carefully prepared for another blow, he sat beside his friend, and keeping an English distance, patted his shoulder. After a pause, he felt a rubbing it roughly, as if it had been the pelt of a dog coming out of disgrace, and said,
"I'm not going to go away. Have a good cry, I would. Then we'll have breakfast, and you'll feel much better."
Then, colouring violently, he bent and kissed his friend where his black curls parted, and standing said,
"You get yourself all cleaned up, and I'll be waiting downstairs."
Stella Ransom, All Saints Rectory, 22nd of September. Dear Francis, thank you for your note. I never saw better handwriting. You must visit as soon as possible, for I am always home, and I look forward very much to hearing what you have to tell me. If, before you see me, you find anything which is blue, I would very much like to have it. With love, Stella.
Cora Seaborn. To the Common, Old Winter, the 22nd of September. Dear Will, how long did you stay alone out there under the beeches in the dark? When you went home, did you sleep? Are you troubled? Has the guilt come yet? Keep it at bay, if you can. I feel none. It's morning now, and there's a heavy fog that brings a curious light into the room, and with it the scent of the estuary. Sometimes I think I'll never escape that smell, as though I've already drowned in it. The fog is pressed so close against the window, I feel as if the whole house must have been blown up into a bank of cloud. Did I ever tell you about my parents' orchard? The trees were trained to grow in ordered rows against a kind of wooden structure. I remember thinking they'd been tortured out of their natural shape, and for two full summers I wouldn't eat their fruit. I remember eating lunch there one afternoon. I must have been a child because I can see my hair lying over my shoulders in two long braids, and it's fair the way it was when I was young. And it must have been spring, because blossom blew into our teacups and onto our plates, and I tried to make a wreath. We had a guest that day, whose name I've forgotten. One of my father's friends, and such a wrinkled, yellowish man, he looked like an apple himself, only one that got left in the dish uneaten too long. He took a shine to me. Seeing my head always in a book and all afternoon came out with things to please me. How to say checkmate is to speak Sanskrit and say the king is helpless. And how Nelson never got over his seasickness. What I remember most of all is this. He said, there are two words in the English language which are spelled the same and pronounced the same, but have opposite meanings. What are they? I couldn't find an answer, and of course that pleased him no end. He said, with a sort of flourish magicians have when pulling silk scarves from their sleeves. Cleave! To cleave to something is to cling to it with all your heart, he said. But to cleave something apart is to break it up. All last night, that word came to me as clearly as if it had been you who told me only hours before. The memory got mixed up with the May blossom falling, and the apples in the grass, and the conkers we found on the path, and the tear in the seam of your shirt. I've never found ways to explain to myself what it is that exists here in our letters, or when we sit together in warm rooms, or go walking out in the woods. And I am not sure it's necessary, not even now, when I still feel your imprint in me. But for now, that word's the best that I can do. We are cleaved together. We are cleaved apart. Everything that draws me to you is everything that drives me away. I'll send this note with Francis. He says there's something he must tell Stella. He has gifts for her, A blue bus ticket from Colchester, a white stone with a blue band. Martha says she'll walk him over the common, and she's bringing a jar of plum jam. Cora.
Chapter 9.
You look well, said Martha, truthful but also a little afraid. Stella Ransom burned with too much life. We're not disturbing you. Frankie wanted to come and says he has gifts, and Cora sends jam, though I'm afraid it hasn't set. Hers never does. Stella sat on her blue couch, wrapped in many blankets. She'd watched them come across the common. First the bobbing of torchlight through fog, then two figures circled by a glow. For a moment she thought she was being called home, but concluded that her summoning angels were unlikely to knock at the door. Besides, hadn't that black-haired boy said he was coming with something to tell her? I feel well, she said. I feel my heart beating fast and strong, and my mind opening out like a blue flower. I tarry only a short while here on the earth, and want very much to live it vividly. Frankie, she was pleased to see the boy, sit there by the window where I can see you, not too close. I've had a bit of a cough lately, though nothing too bad. I've got things for you, said Francis, and kneeling a discreet distance away, laid out the bus ticket, the blue banded stone, and a foil sweet wrapper the colour of a robin's egg. Navy, cyan, teal, he said, touching each in turn. Then he put his hand in the other pocket and took out a white envelope. And I've got to give you this, which is a letter for your husband from my mother. Cyan, said Stella, delighted, making a note of it. Cyan, teal. Really, there was no end to the boy's charms. Her own children were returning to her tomorrow. Would they also understand? She suspected not. Put your treasures on the windowsill there, where I've left a gap, and we'll give William his letter. He'll be pleased. He missed her while she was gone. She turned her eyes on Martha, who wondered what they saw and what they did not. Is he here? Martha said, curious. Cora had wandered home late in the cool evening, dazed as if with drink, though there'd been nothing telling on her breath. She'd said, we had such a good long walk. And curling in a chair, fallen immediately asleep. In the garden, feeding Magog, if he can find her in the mist. Joe will be home tomorrow and will go straight out there and want to know what she had for breakfast and whether she still pines for Cracknell. Go and find him, why don't you? And take him the note. Stella lowered an eyelid very slightly at Francis, who understood that his new friend wished them to be alone and felt himself grow warm with pleasure. "I've got something to tell you," he said when Martha had gone. He stood precisely where he'd been told to stand and no nearer, very straight and rigid with the importance of what he had to convey. "So I understand," said Stella. Suffer the little children to come unto me. Her own babies were coming, and here in the meantime was another, and she'd cradle him close if she could. Sometimes she looked down at her arms and thought she saw love seeping out of every pore. What is it? I won't be here much longer, you see, so you have to tell me quick. I disobeyed my mother, said Francis, a little cautiously. He did not consider this to be a sin, but had observed that it was looked on dimly in most quarters. "Ah," said Stella, "I wouldn't let it trouble you. Christ came not to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance, after all.
Francis didn't know about that, but relieved to see he was not to be told off, edged a little closer, rolling the brass button in his pocket between finger and thumb.
I got up this morning at 5:30, and I went down to the salt marsh, and that man Banks was there, and there was lots of fog. I wanted to see if I could see it, the serpent, the trouble. What they said is in the water. They told me they'd found it, but I wasn't sure, because obviously I hadn't seen it.
Ah, the Essex serpent. My old adversary, my foe.
Stella's eyes glittered, and the hectic colour on her cheeks spread upward. She leaned forward and said confidingly,
I hear it, you know. It whispers. I write it all down.
She flicked through her blue notebook and held it out, and Francis saw written over and over in two neat columns,
Coming, ready or not.
It's all right, said Stella, wondering if she'd frightened the lad.
You and I understand each other, as I have always said we do. They have been deceived, Francis. I know the enemy. It can be placated. It's been done before.
She looked down at her palms and read them. Surely there were sores coming where the headlines crossed the lines of memory. She held them up, but Francis saw nothing.
Well, he said, pressing on, there was such a lot of fog I couldn't see very much, but then I heard a noise, and there it was.
He flung out his arm as if the Essex serpent might creep out from behind the dining table.
Just there, big and dark and moving. I could have thrown a stone and hit it if I wanted. Well, I looked and looked, and I tried to tell Banks, but he wouldn't come. And then the fog was gone for a bit, and the sun came out, and I saw what it was.
He told her what he'd seen, and how he'd laughed, and how then the fog and the tide had swallowed it up.
Oh, she said, disbelieving, as he'd feared she would be, a little let down. Then, oh!
And she, too, fell to laughing, and could not stop. Francis watched, recalling how his father once had reached for his throat, as if it could be coaxed into being calm. His father's illness had interested him without troubling him, but as Stella's eyes streamed with tears, his own wetted in response. Should he help her? He crossed the carpet and gave her a glass of water. The fit passed, and she sipped gratefully. Then, clasping her hands in her lap, said,
Well, then. Well, Francis, what are we going to do about it?
We should show them, he said. We should go down there and show them.
Show them, she said. Yes. The substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen.
She patted at the beads of sweat which settled in the cleft above her lip.
The people that walked in darkness will see a great light. We will deliver them out of their fear. Give me my notebook. Hand me my pen. I am a ready writer. Come.
She patted the vacant seat beside her, and Francis knelt there, leaning on her arm, watching her leaf through pages blotted with blue ink.
I will show you what we'll do, you and I.
She began to sketch, her moment of weakness forgotten. Her small body radiated vitality and purpose.
It is my time, she said. The sands are sinking. I have heard it calling.
I am wet to my ankles in blue water.
Francis wondered if he ought to be troubled, or should call for Martha. The woman's white hands trembled. Her words were tangled strings of bright beads. The black